and welcome to edition 414 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Daniel Giacopelli.
Coming up on this week's show, election fever. No, it's not your hangover. We'll be taking the temperature of the UK after this week's general election. Journalist and author of political thrillers, Terry Stiassny, will be here and trying to make sense of it all.
We'll also be hearing from Canadian cartoonist, illustrator and animator Guy Delisle. His new book, Hostage, tells the visual story of Christophe André, a humanitarian worker taken hostage in Chechnya in the 1990s. Luckily, he made it back again to tell Guy his tale.
Then we'll be getting ecstatic with Jules Evans. The philosophical writer's new book, The Art of Losing Control, seeks to learn why letting go might be the best way to get a better hold on life. He'll be with us at the end of the show.
All that plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be barely clinging on to next week's news agenda. And we'll play some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
What a week, Tom.
Danny, political volatility have been very much the watchwords of the last, 18 months? More of the same this week, in your homeland, in mine.
What I'm most concerned about, Tom, is that the last week has proven? One of the two. That we don't know anything.
Nobody can
predict anything. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Everybody's wrong. Brexit, Donald Trump, Jeremy Corbyn.
No, Danny, you're not wrong. I mean, it's full of surprises. I kind of like it. Life is full of surprises. You have to deal with it. I don't know, there was a strangely sort of more almost positive feeling on the streets of London on Friday morning, even though we're still racked with indecision, basically. We had a very critical time in British politics. But very, very interesting times.
I did ask, though, a few people around the office, as the resident Yank here in the office, is there any chance whatsoever that Jeremy Corbyn could come anywhere close to number 10? Everybody said no. And look what happened. Everybody said no.
Yeah, but you can never say never.
But I think you said never, actually.
One thing you can always guarantee, a man who's never behind the news, always one step ahead. Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry.
Henry Rhys Sheridan joins us here in Studio One right now. A very good afternoon to you, Henry.
Good afternoon, Tom. Shall I just go straight into it?
And who else?
You can wish Danny a good afternoon as well. Danny, I know he's a challenge at times.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good day, sir. All's good here. Continue.
Where should we start, Henry?
On the 12th of June, Sotheby's, the auction house, I'm sure you frequent it, Tom.
I buy some of my antiques there.
To hold an auction, well, you might be interested in this because it's holding an auction dedicated to the classical world, a world from which you come and which I know you're fond of.
I grew up in the classical world.
Apparently, works of art from Greek, Roman, and I don't know how to pronounce this next word.
Etruscan.
Yes.
Oh, I was just guessing.
He knew. Is it Etruscan?
So that's Etruscan, before the Romans came.
When is Etruscan? Before the Romans came.
I believe it's pre-Roman, right, Tom?
Sorry, I zoned out for a moment.
You're a learned man. Etruscan, I think that's pre-Roman, right?
Yeah.
You have no idea. So Sotheby's is auctioning off
we got some
mementos from the era.
Yes. What do you think of this statement from the press release? Potentially controversial. Collecting ancient classical marble sculpture has been considered synonymous with good taste and the apex of culture.
Marble. Hmm.
It's a sweeping statement, Tom. You're prone to sweeping statements.
Well, you know me, Henry. My tastes are more in the contemporary art realm. And much as I like a piece of Etruscan figurative marble sculpture as much as the next man, I'd probably go for something a little more contemporary.
So you won't be placing a bid?
I might be. Let me have a look at some of the lots on offer.
Estimates range from £2,000, fairly reasonable, to £500,000. A lot of money. But yeah, that's going to be on at the 12th of June if anyone wants to acquire some ancient marbles.
Etruscan vase, maybe.
Maybe.
Roman amphora.
Also on the 12th of June.
What a busy day.
Russia's going to celebrate its National Day.
James Comey Day. No, go on, sorry.
Wait, I don't get that.
It's a topical joke.
Okay. So.
Have you been. Okay, continue, Henry.
The country declared independence from the Soviet Union. Funny way of putting it, considering it was the main constituent part of that bloc. In 1990, and this has been celebrated every year since 1992.
Can I jump in there, Henry?
Yeah, go.
I was talking to your colleague and mine, Melkon Shoglian, a week or two
you
ago.
You garbled his name there a bit. Malcolm Çarçoğlu'nun.
Yes.
Yes.
A man from behind the Iron Curtain at one point.
Well, exactly. And he has an understanding of these things. And he was telling me that Russia has an almost immeasurable number of various national days.
Really?
He was telling me a couple of weeks ago it was Children's Day.
What did that entail?
Celebrating kids and that.
Oh, we have those things in the UK as well.
But apparently they take it very seriously.
It was National Sandwich Day a couple of weeks ago here in the UK.
I mean, one of my favourites.
Would you like to hear about some of the ways in which Russia's country people have celebrated it? In 2009...
Is that the correct term?
Russians, do you mean?
Residents of Volgograd formed a map of the country covering 127 square metres. Pretty impressive.
That's good.
In Sevastopol, used paths through the city centre carrying a 30-metre flag of Russia. In Moscow, in Revolution Square, that day, a 2-metre Kokhlomodol was painted. Do you know what a Kokhlomodol is?
Not at all.
Neither do I. I thought you might be able to enlighten me. Just a few things.
Oh, we're moving on. We don't know what that is.
No. Do you know?
2 metres doesn't sound very big either.
Well, it depends how big a normal Kokhlomodol is, isn't it?
Fair point, it's
relative. And finally, on the 11th of June, London is going to host Women's Tour for the first time. It is the UK's biggest professional women's cycle race. And I thought I'd bring this up because I have noticed that a greater degree of attention has been being paid to women's sport recently. And I think that...
Long overdue, I say.
It's long overdue. I think it's a good thing.
Are they not rolling around outside the streets of London literally as we speak?
I think they are.
They are. They're going to be replicating the iconic circuit used on last year's Tour of Britain. You must remember that,
classic.
Tom.
Now, both of you guys are very big cycling fans. Let's put it that way, right? Tom, you follow the Tour de France?
Big time.
Henry, I see you cycling into work all the time with your trousers pulled underneath your socks and your helmet on.
But I'm a militantly, this is going to contradict your description of me, I'm a militantly casual cyclist.
Okay.
So I see myself as being ideologically opposed to the mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra, that normally accompany me on my commute. I jive with their sensibility. Somehow.
Cycling is a pretty cohesive subculture.
It is, isn't it? It's weird, I think.
It's a cult, one would
say. I'm with Henry, though. I think you've got those all the gear, no ideas people. And also, I mean, I'm middle-aged, but I'm not Lycra clad. And I like to maybe go for a bit of a turn through, you know, down a country lane on my bike.
You're more of a Rafa man, probably.
Well, I'd probably just wear my usual threads.
I like the idea as well of being able to get off your bike and walk into wherever it is that you're going.
In your case, probably a public house.
Exactly, precisely. Maybe go from home to work to the public house without having to...
Without changing. Precisely. I have had some complaints from colleagues.
About?
You.
In a general sense.
Well, you come flying in down your desire line through Finsbury Park, hop off your bike, sweating like it's going out of fashion, and just take your seat at your desk.
Would you prefer me to behave in a way befitting, for example, Alex Funnell, one of the sound engineers here at Midori House, who has a shower every single day after he's come in?
I should hope he does!
At work.
I don't like getting into any of this. I think you come to work, you wear what you want to wear to work.
In your case, some sort of vintage fisherman's jacket.
I take the bus, I get off, and I'm at work. None of this exercise. Why exercise?
It's functional, isn't it? It gets you from A to B. I feel we're losing the plot a little. Basically, if you're in London town today, head out onto the streets and applaud
the lady cyclists.
Superb female cyclists.
So, Henry, you won't be joining the women cycling around central London today?
I will not. I fear I'm not quite up to their athletic standards.
Okay. It is a pro race, some kind of classic, I think. Tammy, shall we cycle on to the next guest now?
Let's do it, Tom.
Now, all this week on Monocle 24, we've been focusing on the UK. The nation has kind of elected Theresa May as its new Prime Minister, but following a campaign that seemed mostly to hinge on which candidate the country disliked the least.
Well, to help us close the week and understand how Thursday's, what you could call a result, plays into the broader political picture, we're joined by the journalist and author Terry Stiassny, a regular voice on Monocle 24, and she's the author of well-received political thrillers such as Acts of Omission and Conflicts of Interest.
Terry jumped into Studio One to speak to Danny and I on Friday morning. This was just as the dust was settling on that extraordinary general election night. And she came to tell us about her experiences and what we possibly might expect next.
Well, I think it reminds me of William Goldman's famous saying to do with the film industry, which is that nobody knows anything. I think if we don't know that by now, after Brexit, after Donald Trump's election, this is a third instance in which absolutely nobody knows anything. A week ago, let alone, you know, 6-7 weeks ago when the election was called, everybody was predicting that Theresa May would win a landslide, that we would be discussing who the next leader of the Labour Party would be now if Corbyn failed. None of these things have happened. And very, very few opinion polls predicted that anything like this would happen. And I think partly the voters have just said, none of the above. We don't really like what everybody is offering us. So we're going to give you a really messy, chaotic something in the middle. And you've got to deal with it. And you've got to work out what we want. And you've got to work out how to take it from here, because nobody's really liking the clear, obvious answers.
But I mean, where did the predictions go wrong? Because again, we just saw what happened with Brexit, with Donald Trump, with this. Nobody predicted this at all. Why do we consistently keep getting this wrong? It's kind of disconcerting that we don't know anything.
Yes, I don't know. And I imagine all of the pollsters, with the exception, I think YouGov had one poll which was very close to the election, where people said, really? There's going to be a hung parliament? The Conservatives won't get an overall majority? Are you sure? And people really mocked that opinion poll. But it seems that they had something right. I think it will take a while to work out, you know, how much was to do with turnout, how much was to do with different results in different parts of the country. I mean, this was a very unpredictable election. Say you look at Scotland, the SNP has lost lots of seats, including to the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. We might have seen a bit of that coming, but not to the same extent. So, yes, we'll have to sort of dive deep into all the data, which is not really my area of expertise, to try and...
Never let that stand in the way, Terry. Oh, I was going to say about that.
That's
point.
Tom's motto.
If we look for the silver lining to various clouds that are certainly filling my head, one is that we apparently have seen an increase in turnout amongst the youth vote, as they call it, the 18 to 24s. If nothing else, if that is up at sort of 70-ish percent, which we've not seen since, I don't know, the late 80s, early 90s, regardless of the motivations, whether it's an endorsement of Corbyn or a dissatisfaction with everything else, that's got to be a good story, right?
Yes, I think, and again, we haven't really seen to what extent, you know, that is absolutely true. Well, no doubt everybody will be rushing to try and find that out. But yes, if young people who've just got the right to vote have actually thought, this is absolutely worth my time to go out and make my little cross in the ballot box, then that is a fantastic thing. And we don't know if that was as a result of a reaction against Brexit and people having thought, it'll all be fine, I don't need to worry about it. But it'll be interesting to see whether we've got a sustainable government of any form that lasts, because people are already talking about the possibility of another general election later this year. So we'd get to do it all again. It would be the third time within 2 years.
And some people in the UK have done 4 in 2 years. We could be up 5, 6.
Elections are fun, Tom.
It's like being in Italy.
Elections are fun.
So, I mean, let's talk in Donald Trump terms, winners and losers. As it stands right now, who are the winners of what just happened?
That is interesting.
I feel like nobody's a winner, Terry. Is that a fair point?
Definitely losers, probably UKIP, right?
Certainly UKIP. They've already lost another leader. UKIP leaders seem to just sort of drop like Skittles.
Well, Farage is probably due another go, isn't he, already?
His third time.
Right. He may come around again. Who knows? It'd be a sort of strange Groundhog Day sort of thing.
Are they just in irrelevance now in British politics then, UKIP?
I think the party is. I don't think its former voters are. Because, again, one of the things we'll need to know is people who had formerly voted UKIP, people who had voted Leave, where did those votes go? Because they obviously didn't go to the Conservatives in the numbers that many people expected. And I think, you know, again, it's that importance of getting out of Westminster, getting out of London, actually going to talk to voters. I mean, Theresa May made a great big play of, which voters are we, you know, I'm going out there on the doorstep and turning up at people's houses when they often weren't in during the campaign. You know, people need to talk to the voters.
She went to a meat market and got booed by a few butchers.
Yes, often they were sort of handpicked people that she met. So, you know, to go back to the original question, I suppose, Theresa May has obviously had a bad election. Jeremy Corbyn has had a relatively good election, but I don't think this will end all of the criticism of him from Labour MPs on his own side. I think
really, even after this extraordinary night?
I think so, because I think many people will still think, you know what, they still don't like his views on many of the issues, particularly people in his own party. And there are Labour MPs who will have come back with a bigger majority, which, yes, may be thanks to Jeremy Corbyn, but it may also give them a feeling that, you know, we we've got a platform to criticise him from as well. You know,
well, and they might think if we had a sort of friendly Blairite at the head of the party, yes, maybe we could have actually won outright or,
yes,
or so on.
I think that's an argument that's still going to go on.
A question I have for you, Terry. We mentioned already your sort of thriller writing and this sort of thing. And again, Danny was talking about Trump stateside, and it's a similar issue here. Does this make that job of yours all the more difficult? Because consistently now, over what, 2 to 3 years, political reality has been certainly as entertaining and, frankly, more ridiculous than fiction. I mean, what do you write next? Just a diary would be more ludicrous than a thriller, wouldn't it?
Yes, honestly, it is really difficult. I have found it really hard over the last year or so. And I actually had my book launch on election night.
Very brave.
I planned it before Theresa May called the election. So I thought, well, I'm not for turning. I'm not moving my book launch. Which my editor was very kind and said, you know, Terry's books, my first book had computer files going missing, and just before that came out, the whole WikiLeaks saga started to happen. And then my second book has groups of political friends turning on one another and destroying.
You're not
each
behind all of this, are you, Terry?
I'm not.
Like
my editor said I'm
Machiavelli.
Sort of very prescient, but my political predictions in the real world have been absolutely hopeless consistently. So, yeah, I can't see what it is until sort of some mist kind of needs to clear. As you say, I don't know what to write next, what the story is, what's going to be relevant
then?
In a couple of years.
Are we in the sort of post-satirical age where we just have to give up on trying to poke fun at our elected officials, or in some cases it seems non-elected officials, and just let reality be its own determinant of people's suitability or otherwise for office?
Oh, I think we absolutely still need to poke fun at them. That's, you know, that's half the fun of it. That's the enjoyable part of it. But I think people are almost doing it for themselves now. I think there's so much more with social media. You don't have to wait for the next week's edition of Spitting Image or Have I Got News For You or whatever it is. People are trading these jokes back and forth, you know, on social media all the time. And a reputation can be made or destroyed within a few hours. I think it's just everything has speeded up, and people are quite quick to form their own judgments about the politicians and their successes or failures.
I mean, if you watch things like Veep or The Thick of It, I mean, real life, it seems now more than ever, really does mirror that kind of stuff. I mean, it does seem like we're becoming more bumbling and ridiculous as a society. I mean, I wasn't alive 40 years ago, but I mean, it seems like back then politicians were a lot more kind of austere and intellectual than they are now.
I think we just see a lot more of what they do and how they think. I mean, one, you know, because I was a political journalist before going into fiction, I saw bits of what you're not supposed to see and what they want. But now you see everything, you know, like Gordon Brown with his microphone left on when he met Mrs. Duffy and called her a bigot. We just get those unscripted moments a lot more. So, you know, they may well have happened in the past, but we just didn't have the means for everybody in a room to film, you know, the politician being dragged away from the microphone or, you know, the egg flying or whatever it is. We just didn't get to see all of that.
Terry, a nice easy question for you then. What happens next? Now, I'm not talking about the political detail and the nitty-gritty, which, frankly, as you've already suggested, is almost impossible to predict. What about this broader trend, though, of volatile, unpredictable politics? I mean, I try and sometimes find reassurance in the idea that these things are somehow cyclical. If there's a divide, I don't know, within the voting public in this country between old and young, well, time will take care of itself and some of those demographics will shift. Is it a question
time
of just,
will take care of itself?
Is it a question of just toughing it out and waiting for this cycle of uncertainty to finish? Or do we just need to maybe accept that we could be in for this rocky road for a political generation or so?
I think people, maybe politicians will start to fill that vacuum a bit more. I think you've seen during the campaign, I think one of the difficult things is we had two leaders that a lot of people didn't find very approachable. They didn't find, you know, particularly they weren't great media performers, any of them, but the people who came out of it well were people, say, like Ruth Davidson in Scotland or Sadiq Khan in London, who I think were just a bit more human. And I think
is it likability? I mean, I know
it's, I honestly think,
say,
you know,
you look at, say, Trudeau in Canada or Macron in France, the next generation, if you like, seem to just be people who are a bit easier to like.
I think it's just that ability to sort of to speak human and to engage with people on a more normal, natural level. And I think that is that appeals to people ultimately. So maybe, you know, I don't know who our Macron is going to be, if we're even going to have one,
because
our politics has seemed to go in the opposite direction from France, and it's split far more rather than moving towards the centre.
Tom, you're still under 40. You have a few years left to
narrowly
to make a run for.
I think my goose is
the Macron of the UK, Tom Edwards.
Well, let's wait and see. Let's hope those characters at least are out there, Terry, and they're not merely confined to the pages, for example, of your books. Remind our listeners before we wrap up where they can buy their copies.
Yes, my latest book called Conflicts of Interest is just out just now from John Murray Publishers, available in all good bookstores, as they would say. My previous one was called Acts of Omission, and I did tell my guests at the election night book launch party, I said, from now on, I'm just going to write nice things happening to nice people in the hope that all of that will come true.
Well, let's all drink to that. Terry Jasny, it's great fun speaking with you. Thanks for talking to us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Tom, before we get into a few more interviews with excellent guests, how about some music?
Danny, always the right time for a tune here on the Monocle Weekly. I think you are going to like this one that I have for you. It's new from Montreal indie poppers Tops, and it's called Further. Is it time to start again?
And that's new from Canada. Tops is the name of the band. Further is the song. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be back in Canada right after this.
In 1997, Christophe André was an administrator working for Médecins Sans Frontières in the North Caucasus in Eastern Europe. While there, the Frenchman was taken hostage and kidnapped over the border to Chechnya. He wouldn't be freed for another 3 months and spent his ordeal mostly chained in a dark room.
Hardly the ideal inspiration most people would draw on for a visual book then. But most people aren't Guy Delisle, the celebrated French-Canadian cartoonist, illustrator, and animator, whose new book, Hostage, tells Christophe's story. Monocle's Christopher Frey recently sat down with Guy in Toronto to discuss it.
Well, I read Christophe André's story on the newspaper, just by chance, and I thought, wow, this is such a great story, because I've always been fascinated by the people that were kidnapped and the story when they come back. But usually when they come back, they don't want to talk about it because it's a traumatic experience. And some of them, when they come back, goes through really hard time. Even in France, I remember that guy, Brice Flotio, that committed suicide when he came back. So I thought, wow, that's such a good way to come back from a kidnapping, that I thought that was great for him. And so I did mention his story in one of my comics that I was working at the time, where I was putting a lot of things together. So I mentioned Christophe André's story in Shenzhen, my first comic book. And one day I went to MSF because I had friends working there, and she told me, you know, Christophe, you talked about him in your book, and he can come with us for dinner. I said, sure, that'd be great. And then I started to ask him a few questions while we were eating, and I thought, he's probably not going to want to talk about that, because I was thinking it would be a traumatic experience. But he was super open about it, and he would take his time to give us all the details. And I remember I was there with my friend just listening to him and going, wow, this is so incredible. Because the article was quite short, and then he was giving us all the details of inside, being stuck there in a house where your people feed you, and then all the escape part that was not in the paper. And I just thought afterwards, well, that would be great if I can turn that into a comic book. And he was okay for it right from the beginning. Yeah,
I think somewhere you said that the fact that he escaped made it easier for him to talk about it.
Yeah, that's what he says. He says the best therapy for kidnapping is to escape. And there's a little interview that he did when he came back in France right after he was there. And that's what he says. He says, I feel like a football player who scored the last goal and won the match. And like he says, he came back from that experience not traumatized, not as a victim, but he actually gained, like he was more stronger after that story than before. So that's why he was very at ease talking about it, which he didn't do much, because when he came back, he did that very small interview and something on the newspaper that I read, and that was it. He went back home, and 6 months after, he went back to MSF, knocked at the door and said, well, what's my next mission? They were very surprised, yeah.
And so what was your process then working with Christophe? I imagine it started with a lot of interviewing On the outset, did you have a particular approach?
Yeah, I did interviews because I realized that just taking notes like that on the fly while he was talking was not enough. And I need lots of precision because I want to make sure that it was exactly like the story he was depicting. So yeah, I recorded him. Took me a long time to do that. Well, I met Christoph in 2001, I think. And then I recorded in 2003. And we spent basically one day just walking around and talking. And I put all that together. I had two documents. One document from the NGO that they wanted to keep a trace of that story. And from that document, I was talking with Christoph and asking lots of questions and lots of details. And when you know that you're going to draw, it makes it complicated because, okay, what these guys look like? Are they all wearing a mustache? What kind of stuff are they wearing? And then I remember asking what the bowl of soup looked like, because every day they would feed him with a bowl of soup, and he says, I don't remember. So, and then I worked with this material almost 15 years after, and I was glad I did it in 2003 because his memory was still fresh.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we would go back to the recording, and I was saying to him, well, you said that on the recording, and then you would say, oh, well, if I said that, then it's probably true.
Like your other books, Hostage could be described as a travelogue, even though much of it happens in a single room where he's held captive, handcuffed to a radiator much of the time. But unlike the other books, this is another man's story, and you've never visited Ingushetia or Chechnya, I don't think. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about the visual research, like how you had to invent this world that had some veracity, obviously. You couldn't just sort of make it up based on some loose details. You must have done some visual research as well.
Yeah, I asked Christoph if he had pictures. But he didn't have any pictures of that, except from the compound where they were. So I had a few infos on that. I remember I asked Christoph to draw me the room. So I had a little sketch of what the room looked like from above. And then, the book was mostly like, I mean, there's 300 pages where he's stuck in that one single room. So I bought a pair of handcuffs, and that was all the reference I needed, basically. And I took pictures of myself half naked, attached to a radiator that we had in the studio. And my friend just went around and just did a lot of shooting, because it's very hard to imagine. Like Christoph was saying, sleeping was complicated because there's like two positions. So I tried myself, and then I took a few pictures, clack, clack, and that was good reference because my drawing had to be a little more realistic than what I do usually. So to have these photos were good. And then after that, when he's in the village and when he goes away or he changed, it was just because when you type on Google Chechnya, you only have ruins. There's just not a single house that was standing up. And I went around, and I've went into Georgia, look at the small village, what they look like. And, you know, I just took my reference from there.
Another challenge visually, I guess, is how do you tell a story that takes place in such small increments of time and obviously still make it somewhat compelling for the reader?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the challenge, to find the balance of the storytelling when you want the reader to turn the page. But it's a very slow paced. A book is different than a movie. I think a movie would be boring, because a movie, if it's 2 hours, you're going to stay there for 2 hours. But the book, you can go faster. So you have your own pace, or you can stop and continue tomorrow. So it's very different as an approach for storytelling. So you have to keep that in mind when you do comic books. So I knew I could do a lot of pages, but there was still a balance to find a little like a minimalistic suspense and the reader that turned the page because they want to know what's going on. But I didn't want the reader to escape quickly. I wanted to him, even though he turned the page fast, he's going to be stuck there with him. And I didn't want to go outside of the room, like meanwhile in Paris they all go crazy because where is Christophe, and then boom, you go back to him. I wanted to have like a very claustrophobic experience where you don't know, just like him, what's going on. And then he was going crazy thinking they forgot about him, about me. And then it's nice to be there as the reader and just feel exactly what he was feeling. So it's an immersive type of story, yeah. And from the beginning, that's what I wanted to do, yeah.
Yeah, and there's that journey inward, I guess, that happens. You're not really leaving the room, but you're traveling along with him as he can't control these thoughts, you know, wondering what's going on with his captors, whether back in France they're actually looking for him, all these things.
Yeah. And yeah, doing that book, it was kind of an answer for me when I read these stories of what would I do if I would be in a situation like that. And someone who's kidnapped, you really feel for him because this can happen to anyone. It's just you're at the wrong place at the wrong moment. And yeah, I wanted really to show all the steps where he actually go towards something like a Stockholm syndrome, because he starts to say thank you to his abductors, and then he says, what am I saying? Like, why do I say thank you to these guys? Then he stops to be Mr. Nice Guy, and for him that's very good, because then he starts to be more in reaction to these guys. He's always watching if something happens. So I wanted to show these steps where he actually goes through a situation that is so extraordinary. Like, he had no control over his life. Even to go to the toilet, it's the people who decide for him. Like, you have no decision. How do you not go crazy? So I wanted to show that, how someone can go through that.
Aside from it taking place in a very troubled place, what do you think Hostage, how it relates to or connects with your other books?
Well, when you travel in Burma, in North Korea, where I've been, well, you see the people having a freedom that is very limited, especially in North Korea, or even Burma at the time, because I was there in 2007. And then you come back home, and it's nice once in a while to think, well, we have such a nice way. Well, we have so much freedom. It's nice to see it and to feel it. And when you come back from this country, you feel it for a while when you come back. And so freedom was, for me, something that we all have that. We all share freedom, but it's nice once in a while to talk about that and to see that in a situation you have no freedom at all, how do you survive? How do you cope with that? And being kidnapped is like the strongest moment where you can be in a situation like that. And for me, the picture of freedom, it's really when Christophe is in front of that door and he knows that the door is not locked because they forgot. And he has 2 hours in front of him before the sun goes down, and he goes in his mind saying, yes, I should open it, not open it. So the question is, are you going to open the door and take your freedom or not? And for me, it's such a concentrated experience of freedom that I thought, wow, this is going to be like a very strong part of the book, well, a strong moment.
Would you describe what you do as comics journalism of the sort that we're familiar with from Joe Sacco, or is it something different, like autobiography?
Well, even though we do talk about the same country on a book like Jerusalem, because Joe was in Palestine, and we show ourselves in the book, and then we do explain a few things about the country, I feel we do very different books, because I really like what Joe Sacco is doing. I've read all of his books, and he's quite an inspiration. But he's a journalist, and he goes and he works on some small aspect. When he goes in Gaza, 53, and he talks about something that happened there, he works with archives people. I don't do that. I just go there, and I don't know the situation, actually. But since I spent 1 year, I don't feel like a journalist, because I do talk about my kids. I talk about the problem with the car. And then I go on the Esplanade des Mosquées, and it's such a beautiful place that I want to explain what it is, because we always think about what Sharon did there and that it explode and all that. But it's on the first place. It's just a beautiful place. So, yeah, I put all that together, and I really more have the feeling of doing postcards, long postcards that I would write to my family to explain them everything that I found funny, strange, bizarre, and then interesting, that I put that in the book. So there's a little bit of not journalistic, but kind of historical aspect and the political aspect. So this makes it a bit journalistic, but the overall is more just walking on the streets and do observations.
With the exception of Hostage, you're very much the central character in your books, and we're experiencing these places through you. How do you differ in real life from the character you've created for yourself in your books?
Yeah, it is me, but since I draw myself, and it's just a few facets of me. That's how it works, actually, because these are the few facets that I use for my books to go around and to be a bit naive, which is what I am, actually. But it shows more in the book, because that's in a situation where I am kind of overwhelmed by the situation, try to understand, being curious. So these are a few facets of me that I show in the book. So that's why it's a bit like a character, but it's me at the same time. It's a funny thing, yeah.
Are you funnier in real person or in the books?
I'm maybe more serious, because since it's a concentration of strange, funny, a bit weird moments, it seems like it's been a year of very exciting stuff. But when I read my notes, there's lots of days like, well, not much happened, this is boring, and then blah, blah, blah. It's 300 days, 360 days, so it looks like a lot.
You started out in animation, but did you always see yourself becoming a comics artist or graphic novelist? And I should point out, yeah, as you did, that your first two books, Shenzhen and Pyongyang, were taking place because you were in those places as an animator. But at what point did the comics artist thing become foreground?
Well, when I was young, I really liked to draw, and I was thinking, well, it would be nice to be a comic book artist. But, being in Quebec in the 80s, there was just no real ways I could see that. So I studied animation, which is the form of drawing that is closer to what I was doing, like cartoon stuff. And I really enjoyed working in animation, which had helped me to travel, because I went to Europe. I was in Montreal, then the production was over, and I worked in Germany, and it was nice to travel and work at the same time. So, and then arriving in France, I discovered the independent movement that we didn't get in Quebec, because it was small publishing stuff, and L'Association, and the book that these young guys were doing that other big publishing house wouldn't do. And that's the place where I could send them my stuff, and they liked it. And I worked doing short stories with them for 5-7 years, and I was doing animation to make a living. And I thought I would probably do that for the rest of my life, because doing cartoon, independent, black and white stuff, there was like a few thousand people would buy a book, and that was it. But then it changed a lot, because a lot of people just like me who stopped reading comic went back to reading comics because of these independent movement comics, and then there was a lot of people all of a sudden. I mean, from Shenzhen to Pyongyang to the Burma book and to Jerusalem, it's like it's bigger and bigger all the time. And I was just there at when the wave was getting bigger, after Pyongyang, doing the animation, I thought, well, I'm just going to try to focus on comics, see how it goes. And now that's all I'm doing. So it's been a very slow process of changing from animation to comic books.
You've been working on this book about Christoph's experiences for, I guess that's 15 years, 16 years, it sounds like.
A long process.
And you've been through a few different versions. Now that it's done, I mean, can you look at the book? Is it something that you're just sort of finished and you want to put away? Or what's your feelings about the book now that it's done?
Well, I'm glad it exists now as an object, and it's on the table and not in my head anymore, going like, well, you should do that, you should do that. So now I can start having other thoughts and other ideas that goes, yeah, you should do this, you should do this. So this one has been a long process. I'm not going to ever do something like that, because after 15 years, the problem is I've been talking about that project so much, people around me, that you kind of feel that you've done it, but no, you still have to go and do all these pages. So yeah, I'm not going to do that again.
That was Christopher Frey in Toronto there, speaking to Guy Delisle, and Hostage is available right now. The human mind is an unfathomable entity, which we're not going to try and understand fully within the next 15 minutes, or possibly the next 15 millennia, but today we're going to give it a very good go.
Jules Evans is a writer, researcher, and philosopher whose new book, The Art of Losing Control, looks at humans' desires to seek out a sense of the other. He's ecstatic experiences, be they in a church, a rave, a gallery, or retreating within ourselves through meditation, can, according to Jules, be found in all walks of life. And he's interviewed everyone from artists such as Brian Eno to religious leaders, and that includes religious fanatics as well, in order to understand more.
And he joins us now to talk about it in person. Jules, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks
very
for having
good
me, guys.
To have you with us. Now, a slightly maybe facile observation and first question which I'd make is, can you really have a book that seeks to understand and explain the art of losing control? Because isn't losing control, by its definition, not something that you can really be in control of?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, this is the kind of paradox.
Is that too clever? Is it too clever for its own good, though?
No, I mean, you make a very good question. I mean, on the one hand, can you manage this? You know, can you manage the ecstatic? I you know, this is a question that human societies have grappled with. I think you can. I think that humans at different times and different places, you know, throughout human history, have tried to develop rituals and ceremonies and practices to help people let go of control and go beyond their selves for connection. And that can be everything from a theater to a festival to ancient cave rituals. You think about the earliest human art, the kind of cave paintings from 15,000 BC. These were places where people went to let go, lose control, and to transcend their ordinary self. But I mean, I don't think you can always completely manage it. It's always a little bit risky going beyond the self. So, and any way we do that can be possibly dangerous. Think about, say, psychedelics. There's now a lot of research around psychedelics that in a properly controlled environment, it can be good for people, but there's still some risk involved. It's the same with religions. It can be messy. It can go wrong. So it's never entirely manageable. But I think we can try to avoid some of the most dangerous aspects of going beyond ourselves.
So the premise of your book is that society and on a personal level, we could all do some good by embracing the emotion of human ecstasy.
So it's not an emotion. That's one thing. Ecstasy, I define it as a moment where we go beyond our ordinary sense of self and feel a connection to something greater than us. Now, that can involve emotions like euphoria and rapture, but it can also be frightening and involve like awe and terror and so on. My basic argument is that we've become very wary of that. Mm. We're afraid of going beyond the self. It's been pathologized over the last 200 years. It's been equated with, ecstasy has been equated with like hysteria or psychosis. But I think where we are as a culture today is we're at risk of getting stuck in ourselves, over self-absorbed, over individualist. And so that's why I think we need to explore ways to go beyond the self that are good for us, because there are risks, as I said at the beginning of our conversation. It can be dangerous. It can lead to fanaticism. It can lead to madness and addiction. So I want to try and help us as a culture talk more about how to transcend the self in ways that are good for us.
Mm. And other solutions, I wonder then, and we don't want to sort of give away all the secrets before people buy the book, but are the solutions available to the individual? Or in a sense, are they things that we as social beings and as societies need to try and look at collectively? Because I always think in this country, you've mentioned it a couple of times already, the emphasis on control, and you think of, I don't know, it feels like the hangover of the Victorian era.
Right.
With this very starchy, repressed...
Keep calm and carry on.
Stereotype, yeah.
Yeah.
So presumably you need a collective response to address something which has been so ingrained through a big all of society.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I think the Victorians, in some ways, they were a bit more ecstatic than we were. I mean, they were big.
They got very excited by a bare piano leg, didn't they? Things like that.
Well, they were very into evangelical Christianity. I mean, this inspired their imperialism. So they were very into like becoming one with the Lord and then going off and risking their lives for God and country. So they were in some ways more ecstatic than us.
Yeah, and also the awe of kind of a scenery and
the
landscapes.
The sublime, romantic, poetry, Turner. All of that, yeah. So I think something happened to our culture in the 1960s. We, in general, kind of moved outside of organized religion, but we were still interested in the ecstatic in some ways. But as you've hinted at, it was quite an individualistic form. We're now more of a spiritual but not religious culture. We all have our own private spiritualities, our private ways to get out of our heads, our private conceptions of some higher power and so forth. The risk of that is, you know, I think the great curse of our culture is loneliness. So how can we find transcendence together? What we hate is the idea of priests telling us what to do and having any say over our sex lives and so on. That's me as well. That's exactly what I'm like. So the question is, can we develop forms of community that aren't authoritarian, that are non-hierarchical, where we can kind of find some transcendence together? So that might look something like, I don't know, the Quakers, for example. They have no hierarchy, but they come together to kind of try and find transcendence together. Or like Alcoholics Anonymous. Groups, you know, millions of people who come together to surrender to a higher power together to find healing, but they have no bishops or bosses, and they just have a kind of shared code and you know, shared places. So you might say the psychedelic community, right? People come together online to share their experiences of trips and different substances, to compare notes. But there's no bishop of the high church of psychedelia. You know, it's non-hierarchical, it's democratic.
And what about that online element? Because it strikes me as interesting. I mean, that's something that's really cropped up only in, what, 20 years or so.
Mm.
This idea of communities that are truly global because they're connected by online. And yet...
yeah.
You're not physically there, and you can never really be sure, can you, if you're interpreting something through this digital means, whether yeah. it's even real or not. Does that make it more difficult to understand how people experience or understand their own ecstatic moments?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can... Databases are useful. There's a website called Erowid. Have you guys come across
Ecstasy
this?
Through databases.
So Erowid is a website for psychonauts, for people who practice psychedelics. And you can list your experience on a different kind of substance. There's something like 8,000 different substances on there. Unbelievable. I mean, 95% of them I haven't heard. People just making different kind of things and then trying them out. But they're kind of comparing notes, and it's useful. As a, you know, this thing happened to me, this thing I tried with this dose, and then I saw this or something like that. So that's kind of useful. But I think we've learned over the last few years with some of the really bitter online polarized political debate that it's very difficult to have genuinely intimate conversations online, and very quickly people just trigger each other and end up, you know, demonizing each other. So I'm a big believer in kind of face-to-face community with a few people where you check in with each other and you try and support each other and hold each other accountable. So one of the things I did in the book was the Alpha Course, right? Which is like 29 million people have taken it around the world. One of Britain's few remaining exports. And it's like a kind of evangelical Christian thing. And it didn't really turn me into a Christian. They try to get you to open up to the Holy Spirit. So it's kind of neo-Pentecostal, right? But the one thing I think is amazing about the Alpha Course is how good it is at building community really quickly. So you meet up with, like, say, 10 or 15 people once a week for 10 weeks, and it's just a space where you can talk about your life and what matters to you. And people bond very quickly because they're opening up. And it makes you think how strange our culture is that we don't have places like that where you can check in with each other anymore and kind of open up in a regular way about what's really going on in your life. We don't really have places where we can get together and sing communally, you know, once a week. These kind of things where we can, like, wish each other well, you know. Mm. So these are some of the absences which the decline of religion has left us.
Well, and is there an irony there then? Because you spoke to jihadis and very fundamentalist religious believers in,
right.
for this book, and I know you have in your research before,
mm.
that you talk about that absence, but is there a vacuum there that needs to be filled? Do people... Mm. You know, is it possible, I don't know what your experience was talking to those religious fundamentalists, that they have sought that community or that collegiate feeling? And
yeah.
of course, it's then interpreted in a truly awful direction. But it's because they're chasing something which is very profoundly absent in their
yeah,
lives.
I agree. So this is how people get radicalized. In some ways, having been through kind of evangelical Christian things, I see what happens. You join a community and they give you a deep sense of belonging and being accepted. It's called love bombing. This is how cults kind of, you know, and people finally feel, oh, this is my real family. And then, you know, step by step, they get you to commit more and more to kind of radical
Even if
steps.
The worldview, you know, in, say, extremist Islam, for example, where
yeah.
there might be a very nihilistic worldview,
yeah.
you can still feel that sense of
oh,
engagement.
Oh, totally, yeah. I was in a kind of Christian community for about a year, and I sometimes found, like, when I'm secular gatherings, I felt they often felt a bit kind of empty and hedonist afterwards. There was no balance, really. Either people just didn't really talk about God or the meaning of life at all, or they never shut up about it. And you know what I mean? Like, it would be great to have a balance where it's okay to sometimes talk about things like faith or what you think of as the spiritual significance of life. But, you know, you didn't have to bang on about it all the time and wear a hair shirt.
I mean, but you also run the world's largest philosophy club.
Yeah.
Which has thousands of members. I mean, is that also kind of an idea that could be exported elsewhere as a way to talk about ideas and kind of join like-minded individuals?
Yeah. I think we're at a funny stage in culture where people are looking for more meaning in life and philosophies to live by. That's partly why you see things like the rise of Stoicism again. People are looking for something that's going to last in difficult times, something deeper than just, you know, how many Instagram followers do I have or that kind of thing.
You know, so, those are the things you worry about, aren't they, at times?
Totally.
So, yeah, I think philosophy clubs are a great place where people can get together to talk about ideas. And I'm amazed at Londoners' willingness to kind of come along and talk about ethics or whatever, you know, quite serious, you know, ideas. Almost all our members are not academics. They're just ordinary people who want to still have a rich intellectual life. And those kinds of philosophy groups are growing all over the world.
I just wanted to ask you briefly, yeah. Jules, before the end. Are you, I mean, you've sort of alluded to this. You're talking about doing the Alpha Course and you sort of said, well, I'm not really a Christian or I haven't sought to understand that world.
Yeah.
Are you a religious man? Is this all research? Where yeah. do the sort of boundaries exist in your own, the yeah. work, the work,
so
the research
I, you do for the I'm books? Walking a fine line as an academic. Usually academics are meant to just do a third-person objective research. If they talk about their own personal stuff, they can just do it right in the epilogue or the last page or something. But I wanted to kind of challenge that and say, look, personal experiences, including my own, are also valid data, as long as you're kind of objective about it and able to hold it, you know. So I was looking for myself for, is there some kind of higher power or God? Do we have a kind of soul that we can explore? These kinds of questions. And I suppose I'm an agnostic in the sense that I think we can explore our souls. We can have, I mean, what I've decided is that on the whole, when we go beyond ourselves, if we're careful about it and seek transcendence, that is good for us. What exactly it is we connect with when we go beyond ourselves and when we find transcendence, I don't entirely know. You know,
I mean, it could be purely neurochemical. And
it could be purely, I don't think, I mean,
synapses and electrons. And
yeah, I think, you know, then you get into the whole kind of what is consciousness thing. The thing is, we don't entirely know what consciousness is. I don't think it's an illusion. I think it's something real. I think when we can get into stages of higher states of consciousness where we're more conscious and one has a, people tend to report a sense of connection to all things. This is one of the most reliable things that happens to people on trips and spiritual experiences, though, you know, that kind of thing. Is that just a feeling? Is it just a sense that we're connected to all things? Or is that a genuine insight? Is our consciousness in some sense connected to other consciousness, some kind of, you know, higher consciousness? I'm tend to the latter. I think that these kinds of feelings and insights point to something real, that, you know, when we feel connected to all things or some kind of higher power, I think we are. I'm not a Christian because I think people have that kind of experience in many different religious traditions. So to say that only makes sense with reference to Jesus, to me, is narrow and wrong and cruel. So I'm a kind of classic liberal woolly Anglican.
These are the kind of people that we like. Definitely. Like. Yeah. Jules, we could talk to you all day. And never let it be said that we shy away from asking and answering the big questions on the Monocle Weekly.
Right here on Monocle 24.
Danny, Jules, fascinating to speak with you. The brilliant book is The Art of Losing Control, A Philosopher's Search for Ecstatic Experience. I suggest that you acquire it immediately to learn some of the brilliance from the mind of Jules Evans. Jules, thanks for being with us on the programme.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Tom, that's it for today. Did you enjoy it as much as I did? Did you reach ecstasy, ecstatic reaches of, I don't know what
joy.
I'm saying.
I know, joy? I reckon I got close. Edition 414 of the Monocle Weekly certainly delivered to me. And it posed, Danny, I found some pretty profound philosophical questions. What I like, though, hey, isn't this ever a show that is unafraid to ask
the big questions
and answer the big questions?
Are you going to join Scientology now? Or are you going to go to a yoga retreat in the Hindu Kush?
I don't know. A little from column A, a little from column B. But good to ask the questions. Good to think. I thought it was mind-enhancing. Just talking to Jules was mind-enhancing.
It was. He was
from where I was standing.
Very soothing voice Jules had.
And, yeah, a generally very enjoyable show. Let's thank some of the people behind it. Tom Hall, of course, our producer, and our studio manager, Claire Urban.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye. From me, Daniel Giacopelli.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
See you later.